I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. I live in Utah in a city called Provo, which, as I understand things, was named for a French-Canadian fur trapper and fur trader. He was active in the Intermountain West and near the Great Salt Lake in the 1820s. Now, I want you to know that Provo, P-R-O-V-O, well, that's the way we spell it. He spelled it P-R-O-V-O-S-T. And I'm just a little bit of a purist, and I wish we could revert to that original spelling because I kind of think a certain violence may have been done to his name by dropping the S-T in Provo, which I realize those are silent sounds in French anyway at the end of a word, but still, nobody to my knowledge changed the spelling of Schenectady, New York, but no, I have to back off of that altogether because I guess the Dutch settlers were there doing their very best to come up with some kind of written equivalent for a Mohawk word that was exclusively oral, never set down in any kind of an alphabet. These things are really messy. The historic names are kind of messy, not just messy. I'm going to say sometimes unfair and ugly, as with a recent condo development here in town named Willowbrook. Willowbrook, it's a beautiful word. There never was a brook anywhere nearby, nor any willows where Willowbrook stands today. It's on a hillside. And hillsides, they're just not the kind of topography for brooks or willows. You know, there's also a vast shopping complex miles north of here called The Meadows. I get to see The Meadows on a billboard every time I pass it on the freeway. The entrance signs sport pheasants, which once lived there. And today it's asphalt parking lots, restaurants, shops, theaters, the kinds of things that go with a Costco nearby. The pheasants are long gone. The meadow is gone, too. The names that we give to places, sometimes they stick. Sometimes they have a history. Sometimes they're just commercial tricks. They almost always have a story, though. And today, we are going to visit with somebody who's very interested in the stories of the names of New York City. Joshua Jelly Shapiro is with us. He's a geographer and a writer whose books include Island People, The Caribbean and the World, and with Rebecca Solnit, author of Nonstop Metropolis, A New York City Atlas. Jelly Shapiro is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, and Harper's Magazine, among many other publications. He is scholar in residence at the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University, where he also teaches. And his latest book is titled Names of New York, Discovering the City's Past, Present, and Future Through Its Place Names. Joshua, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
So are you from New York originally? Is that a place with the deep roots for you?
You know, I was not born in New York, nor did I grow up there. I grew up in the bucolic state of Vermont, so it's a few hours north of the city. But I have family roots in New York. You know, my family story, like many Americans' family stories, runs through Ellis Island back a few generations. And I've always spent time in New York and visited New York, and I've lived there now for a chunk of my adult life. So my sort of deep family story runs through New York, and now mine does as well.
Well, New York is a very big place, and I would imagine that as you arrive there, you just kind of accept the names that are given you, the place names.
Absolutely. You know, and that's one of the things that I was interested to explore in this book, is that names, of course, we just take at face value. We think, oh, okay, this is New York City. But what does New York mean? You know, what does the name of the city itself mean? What do the names of all of the neighborhoods in it mean, from Soho to the Upper East Side, to Gramercy, to Brooklyn? You know, all these names that make up a place and perhaps become iconic or gain meanings larger than themselves.
Should people become invested in all of the baggage or history or backstory of names?
One thing that I'm passionate about, and I loved your introduction, thinking about the origins of Provo, or of course, the origins of the place name Utah. Of course, that's its own story. And for me, place names can be a portal into history. They can enrich our sense of where we are. They can give us a way to understand the people who've shaped the place, whether those people are the indigenous or settlers and colonists from Holland or England, in the case of New York, or from France or wherever else. So place names can be the sort of way into history. And I think that that's important and a wonderful, wonderful thing, a wonderful way to learn the past. In recent years, we've, of course, had a sort of vital and important conversation, I think, and it's ongoing, of course, about the ways in which names can signal past violence or can signal the ways in which land was taken from people or the violence that's done in the interest of settling a place. And those are important and absolutely vital conversations, as I say. But I think for me, it's always very interesting, too, to think about the ways in which the meaning of a name can change over generations. In New York, you know, a great example of this, for example, is the place named Harlem, right? Harlem, of course, now iconic of African-American freedom and pride and culture because of the people who've settled in Upper Manhattan over the last century and more. But Harlem, of course, is a Dutch place name. It was placed there in Upper Manhattan by Dutch settlers associated with the Dutch West India Company because it reminded them of a village at home, or at least they hoped it might remind them of that village back in Holland. And it's fascinating to think about the ways in which just the sound of that Harlem, those two syllables, you know, later on, fast forward a few centuries, and it lends itself to all these wonderful songs and poems and stories that make that name and those syllables symbolic of something else, something different from its founders. And I'm fascinated by the ways in which the meanings of names can change and shift over time and why we become attached to some names and leave others behind.
I want to toss out a fun word. I've never said this word aloud before, and I don't even know if I'm going to pronounce it right. Toponymy?
Yes, you said it perfectly, in fact.
Yeah. Is that a useful phrase? And what do people think about toponymy?
Yes. Well, toponymy, right? I mean, comes from, right, topos, topo meaning place, and toponymy is just the study of place names, right? And of course, it's a very niche field, as you can imagine, not something that you can get a university degree in. I studied geography, and now I work as a writer. But yes, toponymy is the study of place names. There are people who do it. And there's a really rich history and tradition of toponymy in North America, in the United States. You know, there's wonderful books reaching back to the founding of the Republic, really, but also a wonderful book published around the time of World War II, Names on the Land by George Stewart, which looks at place names state by state all across the nation and sort of digs in into the stories behind them. And so that tradition is something that's important to me. I've always loved reading those books, and I just think that they enrich our sense of place and our sense of where we are and of the historical forces that have shaped where we are. One thing I've tried to do in my work is to absolutely to dig into those histories and think about where names come from, but also to explore the ways in which they shape our sense of place and they shape our sense of what's possible now. And so that's one of the aims of this book, is just to think about those deeper questions, not just about, you know, where names come from, but what they do.
My wife and I, we had the privilege of naming our children. That happens to a lot of parents. And
indeed.
And there's a lot of value that people put into the giving of names to places as well as to children and people and pets, for that matter. When it comes to places, there's a kind of aspect of control, I suppose. Would you address this control? Because we think we've got that control in naming a thing, and yet once it's out there, anything can happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I begin the book by just saying, you know, names matter. Any parent who's named a kid can tell you that. So can any kid who's, you know, got a name that they grow up to hate. So, you know, names matter. And sometimes we change them. Sometimes we change our own names if we feel like they don't fit who we are or who we want to be. But yeah, place names are interesting to me for this reason, among many others, that they're put on a map often by, you know, whoever has the power to do so. In colonial times, it's someone who's coming and settling a place or charting it for their colonial sponsor or whoever. And a name can stick if people like it. It can also go away if people don't like it. But the ways in which a name can kind of change and shift in meaning and also in how it sounds across time is something that's always been fascinating to me. I'll give you a couple examples from New York, which of course has many Dutch place names. The Dutch founded New York as New Amsterdam, right, in the 17th century, and many English names. But there are many names that are, in fact, sort of anglicizations of Dutch words. Coney Island is one. In Dutch times, it was Coney Islands, which meant something in Dutch. It meant Island of Rabbits. the English came along and decided, I suppose, that they liked the sound of that, even though it doesn't mean anything in English. So now we have Coney Island, which is famous for its amusement park and beach in southern Brooklyn. Gramercy is another one. Gramercy Park in Manhattan, a kind of tony, beautiful district of Manhattan. Gramercy sounds vaguely English, but in fact, it comes from a Dutch place word, the Crow Marsh. In Dutch meant crooked marsh. And essentially the English took those syllables and turned them into an English sounding word, Gramercy, that doesn't mean anything in English, but it does contain those layers of those who named it and now has taken on new meanings in the present. So I'm fascinated by how names can shift in their sound and in their meaning.
Well, I love the example of Gramercy because it kind of shows how little control we have over these things, that they just kind of morph and shift whichever way they want to, and then public popular opinion will prevail, I guess.
No, I think that's the case. And there are many, many cases in New York City, and I'm sure this is true all over the country, right, of sometimes local governments will offer a new name. In Manhattan, for example, we have Sixth Avenue, which in the 40s, we had a mayor who tried to change the name of Sixth Avenue officially to the Avenue of the Americas, to kind of give it some new cachet and become a rival to Fifth Avenue, which is, of course, iconic already. And it's an interesting story because basically, the people and tenants and businesses on Sixth Avenue never really took to this new highfalutin name, Avenue of the Americas, even though it was on street signs for a few decades. In the 1980s, the city relented and said, okay, officially, we're going to keep the Avenue of the Americas name, but we're also still just going to call it Sixth Avenue. We give up because we want people to use the name that they're comfortable with, right? And so this happens with surprising frequency, right? People kind of decide which names they like best and use them as they will.
One of my favorites from your book has to do with Rip Van Winkle. Who doesn't like that story? It's just but there's a bridge, I guess?
Absolutely. There's Rip Van Winkle Bridge, which crosses the Hudson some ways north of New York City. But of course, Rip Van Winkle is a creation of fiction. He's a character in books from Washington Irving, who wrote these stories of old New York, of this sort of imagined Dutch past, which in many cases were fiction. You know, he wrote about these Knickerbockers and old sort of imaginary Dutch figures. And I love how a figure from fiction, others include Ichabod Crane, right? Another of his characters. But you have, Rip Van Winkle Bridge crossing the Hudson, named for a character of fiction, not a character from history.
Now, you've devoted an entire chapter to islands. You're a geographer, and so it's going to be kind of interesting to just kind of look at the lay of the land and where the water is. But islands, they get the same treatment as streets, I guess, and it's just kind of willy-nilly, whatever comes up and whatever sticks.
It's funny, you know, islands, I think, have a particular way of firing human imaginations, right? We've always looked to them as these kind of utopias or prisons or paradises. Islands sort of fire the imagination, as I say. And New York, when you think about it, is a city of islands. You know, Manhattan itself is an island. Brooklyn and Queens are on the end of Long Island. Staten Island is another borough. But it's also got all these little islands in the harbor, which many of them have marvelous names. You know, there's North Brother and South Brother Island. There's an island called Big Tom. There are islands obviously named for Liberty and for Ellis, where immigrants arrived to New York. And many of those names, of course, just come from people who are sailing around the harbor at one time or another in colonial days and thought to name these places after something they evoked for them or obviously after an owner, right? But yes, islands can take on all these names across time, but I'm fascinated by the ways in which islands take on meanings as well.
There is a story you tell of a boulevard named after one Dr. Theodore Kazimierov, I believe.
Yes.
My hesitation in even saying the name should signal right there that there's a problem with naming a street Kazimierov Boulevard, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and that's an example of a street that was named in the honor of a a wonderful, illustrious citizen of the Bronx who was a dentist, but also the borough's first official historian for some decades in the middle, late 20th century. And the city named a stretch of Southern Boulevard, a main thoroughfare in the Bronx, for him, Dr. Theodore Kazimierov Boulevard. But as you indicated, as you were saying this street name, people never quite took to it. And I think that that's in large part just because it's not an easy place name or street name to say, right? And so, again, that was a case where the city relented. And his name is still affixed to that street as an honorary street name. But they made the official name is once again Southern Boulevard, because that's the name that people like to use in that part of the city. So sometimes, as we say, this can be determined just by what people like to say and what they don't like to say.
This is kind of fraught because there are going to be winners and losers. And I understand with Kazimierov Boulevard, there was a loser there. I guess he was deceased, but when the name was given up, his widow was still alive. And you say that she wasn't too happy about that.
No, she wasn't too happy about it. But I think that one way in which the city kind of attenuated that is by leaving his name up as an honorary name. So it wasn't as insulting as it might have been. And this is actually one of the things that's unique about New York in comparison to other cities. All cities, of course, have their own policies and procedures for how names happen and how name changes happen. But New York, since the 1990s, has had an especially kind of liberal or prolific, you might say, policy of allowing honorary second names to be affixed to streets. They let the city council essentially do that as they wish. And so city council people, perhaps predictably enough, have availed themselves the opportunity to write name street corners and squares and parks and boulevards after illustrious citizens from their districts, whether celebrities and baseball players or movie stars or ice cream vendors or whoever else they want to name streets after. So New York has this whole second order geography, if you like, of honorary street names just named, just sort of laid atop the official names. You have all these second names.
Are they aware of what's up here? Because it just sounds so schmoozy.
Yeah. I mean, it is pretty schmoozy. I think people take such pleasure in a certain sense out of, seeing, Regis Philbin came from this block of the Bronx, and now we have a street named after him. Or, the rapper Big Pun last week just got a street named after him in his part of the Bronx. So I think people take pleasure out of sort of seeing this stuff go up. But I think there is absolutely a debate about whether it's sort of gone overboard or if we have too many of these things at this point. And I'll give you, one other example is that in New York City, like many cities and towns across the country, right, there is a street named for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Many places in the U.S. after the Civil Rights Movement gained streets to honor Dr. King and his vision. But in New York, it's 125th Street in Harlem, which already was this, thoroughfare that was iconic of many of the ideals that Dr. King espoused around racial justice and pride and so on. And so many people actually in Harlem, in that part of Manhattan, no one calls 125th Street MLK. They call it 125th Street still, because it was already symbolic of those ideals. So as I say, it's this, I think people get a kick out of seeing these names go up and they enjoy the histories that they honor and so on. But to return again to the point, the first point of a street name is for people to use it and to get around. And so that is often determining as to whether a street name sticks or doesn't.
There are people who are real sticklers for language usage. It has to be a certain way, and maybe they like it the old-fashioned way, and they think things should never change. And sometimes they'll even point the finger and say bad grammar when really it's just a usage thing. Language is always in flux, and I'm wondering if the naming of places is just exactly like language as a whole.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely the case. And I think that, it's also very interesting to look at fashions in naming. In the 19th century, for example, there was a huge kind of moment of Francophilia, if you like, where American place namers got into these French suffixes for places, Ville, most notably, that we have you know, Charlottesville and Danville and all these cities named Ville, right? And that was a sort of moment of being into the French way of doing things. Avenue is another sort of borrowed from French. It was a name for a stately, right, sort of driveway on a grand estate. And American city planners got into calling big streets avenues at a certain point in the 19th century. So many of these expressions, right, they don't necessarily reflect accurately sort of what they're describing in the place where they're coined, but then they become symbolic of or attached as meanings and as labels to those places in new ways. So it's a fascinating way in which naming goes through different fads and stages and evolutions like anything else. And you can, if you know those sort of moments in the history and can sort of peel back the layers to think about the history of place names, those things become evident.
In just a moment, I want you to talk about Sesame Street and Scrabble Corner. But first, I just have to comment. There has been a craze around here over the last decade to name something a point, and it always has to have an E on the end of point. It's not – so we drive around town and we joke and we say point. We never say point. And that's that kind of Francophile thing going on, I think.
Absolutely. No, I think there's in the so-called New World, especially, I think there have been these different moments of trying to sort of lend our places this sense of history or heritage or sort of a whiff of the old world.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah, point is when you see, you know, a shop that's S-H-O-P-P-E, just kind of, you know, ersatz old English. It doesn't convey anything other than, oh, we're trying to be sophisticated or old worldy here. But absolutely. And you see that sort of time and again throughout history, people trying to sort of lend the places that they inhabit this kind of prestige, whether in foolish ways or not.
Sesame Street,
of course, the greatest and most successful, I should say, you know, children's TV show in history, has more Emmys by far than any other program in the history of TV. Got its start in New York in 1969 on public television in the city. And essentially, right, what it tries to depict is a kind of idyllic New York City block inhabited by a bunch of creatures that we don't actually have here. I haven't seen an 8-foot
not lately.
Bird. not lately, or Snuffleupagus. But of course, it was a show that was trying to, right, use television, this sort of relatively new medium, to educate kids and to teach them about values of tolerance and kindness, along with their ABCs and all the rest. The story of Sesame Street is very much a New York story in certain ways. And of course, it wasn't actually shot on the street, and there is no such actual place as Sesame Street. It was shot on a soundstage in Queens. But a few years ago, Sesame Street, having just celebrated its 50th anniversary, or doing so last year and this year, there was a push by the creators of the show and local council people and so on in Manhattan, where it's produced on the Upper West Side, to commemorate just the success and amazing legacy of Sesame Street in the lives of kids and many of us who grew up on it, right? And so the city finally did grant, there's an actual Sesame Street on the map and in the streets of New York now. It's on, let's see, 65th Street, if I get it right.
Were you able to find out if anybody in the neighborhood there welcomed that? I mean, open arms for the new name?
Yeah, I think, you know, think about Sesame Street. No one hates Sesame Street.
I thought so.
So, yeah, no, that's a universally beloved thing. So it's one of those that it's a second street name. It's an honorary street name. So it's just, it didn't change the name of that corner. But there is this sign there that I think everyone who walking by now loves the fact that there's an actual Sesame Street in New York. So here's to that.
You know, it kind of sounds like there have been too many people who've been burned by trying to officially change a name wholesale all the way down. And so you got this kind of tentative, we've got an honorary name or we've got a secondary name. It's like they're not going to commit to it in a way, you know?
That's the thing. It's a topic of real debate, actually, in New York around, okay, it's nice to have all these second names, but it's also not we're not committing to actually changing the map. And perhaps that's a good thing. Perhaps it's not.
Yeah.
We'll go back and forth on that.
Well, before I let you go, tell us a story about Scrabble. And this is kind of fun.
If there's a favorite honorary street name in the city, I think Scrabble Corner, as it's called, might be my favorite. Yes, in the borough of Queens, in the neighborhood of Jackson Heights, there's a corner where essentially the street name, it's on 37th Avenue and 84th Street, the street name has a subscript number after each letter in it, like on a Scrabble block. Right. And there's a reason for that. It basically hails the place where Scrabble, the most popular word game in history by most measures, board game that is, was invented in the basement of a church in Queens during the Depression by an architect called Alfred Butts. And the story of the Scrabble Corners basically starts 20 years ago or so, where someone who was aware of that history added these little subscript numbers to the street sign there. To recognize that history. It wasn't official, and the Department of Transportation, because it was subtle, they didn't take it down for a while, but people in the neighborhood grew to love it. And so when they finally did take it down, there was kind of an outcry. Local politicians and a new city council person agitated for the city to make that place official. And so now you have a Scrabble sign there that commemorates in a quite subtle and wonderful way the birthplace of the game Scrabble. And it's an official place on the books, an official place on the streets of New York, the Scrabble Corner. So if you're ever in Queens or flying into LaGuardia Airport, it's actually not that far from there. You can go pay respects to where Scrabble was invented.
Now, I have not played Scrabble in a long time, so I don't know about the point scoring system and if those letters and their numbers are accurate. I presume they've got to be accurate on that sign. A V's got to be worth 4 and an A just worth 1.
You're exactly right. Yes.
They got it.
It's true to life. Yeah, they got it right.
Well, Joshua, a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. And I'm not from New York. I've spent so little time in the city that when I get there, I'm going to have your guidebook. And is it a guidebook or is it just a fun romp or a collection of essays? How would you describe Names of New York?
Yes, well, it's full of information, of course, about where these names come from and the geography of the city. But it's written as a kind of journey, as a travelogue through the city. It's written as an essay, as a set of stories and encounters with people. So it's definitely not a reference book. It's a fun, slim read, I like to think. So I'd be honored if you check it out whenever you come to the city.
Hey, a pleasure to meet you, and thank you for being with us today on Constant Wonder.
Thanks so much, Marcus. Appreciate it.
Joshua Jelly Shapiro with us. His book is titled Names of New York, Discovering the City's Past, Present, and Future Through Its Place Names. A rose by any other name, Juliet told Romeo. You know how that line goes. But would Park Avenue by any other name be the same? As sweet? No. What does your street address say about you, assuming you have one? Many people do not. What's in an address, after all? We're going to find out when Constant Wonder returns in a moment. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We've been chatting this hour about place names and what they might be able to tell us about history. Turns out the greatest proliferation of place names is probably in the category of street addresses. And these addresses can sometimes convey quite a bit about who we are. Of course, they tell us where we are, but apparently, the majority of the world's dwellings do not even have a street address at all. And to learn more, I spoke with Deirdre Mask, who is a lawyer and a writer. She's author of The Address Book, What Street Addresses Reveal About Identity, Race, Wealth, and Power. Let's jump into the conversation with a discussion about the Universal Postal Union, which was created in 1874. Its job was initially to make sure that the mail can get where it's supposed to go. And today it has an extra mission to try to get everyone in the world an address.
So they are basically the international coordinator of the world's mail. I was really going on their website partly. Think about, for example, at the time I was living in Ireland, my husband's Irish, and I was sending a letter to the United States. And I was wondering, you know, how does this work? When I buy my stamp in Ireland, you know, how does it work? You know, how does the U.S. get its cut for delivering the mail in the U.S.? So they sort of deal with all that nitpicky stuff of international mail. But they also deal with, you know, this broader question of addresses and deliveries as well. So they basically are sort of pushing a project, but there are lots of NGOs and the World Bank as well is very interested in this. They said it's one of the cheapest ways of helping pull people out of poverty, and they've launched huge addressing programs in countries all over the world.
One of the cheapest ways to help lift people out of poverty. You have several examples of that, I know, ranging from Haiti to West Virginia.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the chapters in my book actually is in Kolkata, which is most people sort of know it by its former name, Calcutta, where there's an NGO from Ireland actually called Addressing the Unaddressed, which is addressing the slums in Calcutta for a few reasons. So I went to Calcutta to see what they were doing and follow the team as they went addressing the slums for this very reason, because people couldn't get bank accounts and they couldn't get really important ID cards. And in India now is a country that requires ID cards to do things like, you know, book a train ticket. So you would go around and literally they're just giving numbers. Now they've teamed up with Google, who's taken over quite a bit of the project, can do it much more quickly. But you saw that people were really grateful for these, not just for the practical means, but there's also a sense of identity and inclusion. Because if you think about it, in the world, you count things that you value, right? Like, you know how much money there's in your wallet, but you might not know how many, you know, buttons are in the jar and in your drawer. You know, you count things that you value. So you definitely got the sense that for some of these people, it was a sense that people wanted a number. They wanted to be counted. They wanted to be on a list, and they wanted to be included, even though they were living in the slums, where technically there's, you know, a lot of them are squatting illegally. They don't have that sense of inclusion in society that we take for granted.
Well, one of the places where your book gets really interesting is when you start going into the idea that there are some people who would prefer to stay off the grid, who would prefer not to be known, maybe some anonymity. Tell us why that's a problem.
Absolutely. I think we've often heard this, right? There's people who sort of, exactly as you said, go off the grid. And if you think about the grid, you know, that sort of has an idea of addresses. If you think of our gridded cities, you know, obviously you're also going off the electrical grid, et cetera. But yeah, the idea of this is actually, if you think about it, it's quite obvious. And I found this, for example, in West Virginia. When I was in West Virginia, they were doing this project to give everybody addresses, which sounds like, as I said, for all these reasons, an amazing project, even if only for an ambulance to come to your door. But a lot of people are really suspicious of this, right? I mean, sometimes there are practical questions, you know, like, what are you actually going to name it? People didn't like it. But some people just didn't want to be named and numbered. And it turns out that those feelings actually make a lot of sense. Because when addresses, as we know them, sort of health numbers, were introduced in the 18th century, people didn't like it. They were unhappy. And here's why. Because the monarchs, they weren't using the addresses to help you, you know, help you get bank accounts or help you navigate around the cities. They wanted to draft you into war. They wanted to find you. They wanted to tax you. They wanted to imprison you. That this was their way of finding you, was by giving you a number that they could eventually find you at. And people rebelled, you know, in really dramatic ways, ripping the numbers off. In one example, attacking, you know, people who are numbering their houses. So we often think of addresses as something that's quite useful for us. But actually, if you think about it, it's far more useful to the government to be able to find you and track you. And often that's great. You know, now it's amazing. Think about the statistics that come out. You know, those are only really possible with fine-grained ways of finding people. If you had no way of labeling, you know, you couldn't do this. You know, ambulances, bank accounts, everything we take for granted. But it also means that if they need to track you down to imprison you, they can find you easily. In some governments, it means if there's a dissident, they can find them easily. They can tax you easily. That's how they find you for taxes. And they can garnish your bank account, because that's how you have your bank account. It's a bit long-winded, but it actually makes a lot of sense for some people to want to disappear off the grid, because those are sort of the origins of addresses.
Well, there's just this very pragmatic business of how a bureaucracy or how a complex civilization and society is going to manage data, manage the demographics. Yeah. There's that aspect to it. But there's also the aspect of sort of the style of naming. And that starts to introduce a very interesting flavor that I think is people aren't going to be quite so suspicious of what the name is. They might be suspicious of getting found or located.
Right. Yes, absolutely. So these people, a lot of people just don't want to be found. But yeah, but then there are issues, as you said, about people just not liking the names of the streets they live on as well. And this was a problem in West Virginia, because when you're naming thousands of streets from scratch, I mean, what do you name them? People went crazy. You know, they were consulting Scrabble websites to find short ones that would show the name. And so some people really were just rebelling from this idea that they didn't have any input. But what I've read from the people I spoke to in West Virginia was it was more this idea of not wanting anybody to be able to find them easily.
Do you like some of the names you've stumbled across? I know you do.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, England's great. I live in London. And because the names here are so old, they're often derived from Old English. They don't actually really make sense, or they sound quite silly in, you know, in modern language. You know, for example, I mean, this is, butt isn't a bad word. The word butt is used in a lot of street names because they talk about water butts. It's where water was collected. But it comes up with sort of fifth grade kind of jokes for street names. But I think for the most part, you know, people now, you know, there are different trends in street naming. You mentioned, for example, you know, trees as street names. You know, that was a big push in America for a long time. But there was also sort of a wave of commemorative street names, of naming them after people. And that's what you get a lot of now in London as well, you know, named after kings and queens. And in America, we get them named after presidents. And some people, divisive or not, also get street names. So there's a lot of texture and history in all those names.
Well, I want to bring up the example of Martin Luther King Jr., yeah, boulevards or avenues, because you address that in a very interesting way, that naming streets after the civil rights leader has been problematic in some areas.
Yeah, it has. And so I have a chapter on, it's a start in St. Louis, where I met a really interesting man, his name's Melvin White. He was a postal worker, who basically just realized that the Martin MLK Drive in St. Louis, which is really, really down on its knees. I mean, literally buildings just crumbling and falling down, high levels of crime and poverty. And it's on Martin Luther King Street. And he thought, you know, why do we often give streets Martin Luther King Street that, you know, aren't really worthy of the Martin Luther King name? And this sort of launched me into thinking about Martin Luther King streets. You know, many of them run through Black neighborhoods. You know, some are very prosperous neighborhoods and some aren't. And others, like St. Louis's, are, you know, completely derelict, really. And often these streets became sort of tied up with negative stereotypes of Black America. And I should add that I'm African-American myself. So, you know, it was a way of talking about this conversation about what's going on when we name something after Martin Luther King. And also there are huge debates over naming streets after Martin Luther King, with a lot of people brazenly saying it's bad for business to name a street after Martin Luther King, which sounds completely absurd. He has a national holiday in America. He's one of the central figures in modern American history. And yet you have people saying this is a terrible thing to name a street after him. So that chapter sort of explores the nuance of what's going on when people say that about Martin Luther King Street and sort of what it says about race in America today.
But somebody undertook an effort to beautify or to improve the Martin Luther King Boulevard?
Yeah, exactly. So Melvin White, this postal worker, exactly. So his mission, he has an organization called Beloved Streets of America, where his mission is to beautify them, to take them back, to make them sort of worthy of MLK's name. So in St. Louis, he's pushing efforts to try to get money into MLK Street, to try to build, you know, housing and do all sorts of things. And basically, it's also sort of, you know, it's practical. He wants to beautify it and make them nice. But it's also sort of ideological in the sense of, you know, maybe we should all get together and think about, you know, Martin Luther King was about peace and lifting people out of poverty and you know, unity. And let's use our Martin Luther King streets as a way of talking about that.
You spent some time talking about Project J in Germany. This is this has a fascinating backstory. Tell us about Project J.
Yeah, so it was there's this artist, she's an abstract artist, her name's Susan Hiller. She unfortunately just passed away last year. But she was on a fellowship in Berlin, and she was walking down the street, and she saw a street called Judenstrasse, which means Jews Street, right? Jew Street. It's kind of an odd name, you know, Jew Street or Jew Street. And she's Jewish herself, and she was really puzzled by this. So she went to look it up, and it turned out that there are over 300 Jew Streets in Germany. And these were sort of practical names, it seemed like, you know, for the most part, you know, most of the early history of early street names is quite practical, as you sort of mentioned. Market Street, because that's where the market was. You have Church Street, because that's where the church was. And this was Jew Street, because that's where the Jews lived. And this was obviously born from a history where, you know, long before World War II, Jews were sort of segregated from society and required to live often on the outskirts of town. So some of these Jew lanes are actually now they look sort of like sort of Hansel and Gretel paths around the city, which were the only way that Jews were allowed to go. They weren't allowed to go through the city. They had to go around. And they were sort of, a lot of them were taken out during World War II and replaced. Almost all Jewish street names. So somebody who was noticeably Jewish that Nazis knew, they took the street name away and added in a Nazi name or a name from German history. Pretty much every town or city would have had a, you know, Hitlerstrasse or a Hitlerplatz. And anyways, after the war, they reinstated all these Jew streets. But it's kind of hard to see. You know, she found this to the reckoning of seeing these Jew streets, you know, Jew streets, but there aren't really that many Jews in Germany left. It sort of became this sort of complex way of thinking about the Holocaust. And it also became a complex way of thinking about what happened in Cold War Berlin, because once the East and the West were joined, they had to reconcile these street names, because the Eastern street names were really communist and the Westerners didn't like that. And so they start changing all the Eastern street names. And this became a complex way of talking about, you know, what does it mean to be German?
At some point, there's just confusion if the names are flip-flopping and changing all over the place. And that alone can complicate the picture. Well, the complicated picture of finding people, whether they have street names or not, there you talk about the dead letter offices, too.
Yeah. So there's something called the dead letter office, which is basically a place where, you know, letters that are badly addressed go. And you have, like, basically these postal detectives who track down where all these street names are, you know, so that you have, and then some people are incredibly good at it as well. So, you know, so they'll have to go into books or they'll research to try to figure out who this person is. And a lot of them contain checks and money, for example. So it becomes this huge industry. The post office is actually extremely good at this, at trying to track down everybody. And some of the old ones from England are just hilarious. You know, it's like, you know, this is to my aunt in Shropshire. She has a wooden leg. You know, so you have people trying to work this out. And these detectives got incredibly good at recognizing misspellings of words and family names and tracking this down to try to figure out where to send these letters.
So even in our modern world, there will be somebody who will address a letter to their aunt in Shropshire with a wooden leg?
Well, that one, but that's an old example. But yeah, there's a funny example. It's not in the book, and I hope I don't get this right. It's easily Googleable. But in Ireland, like I said, my husband's from Ireland. It's a small place. There's some letter that was addressed to somebody in a small town that says, your man with the glasses, who's doing a PhD at Queen's University. And when it gets to him, right? Because there's this idea that, you know, you can kind of, you know, negotiate it down, and then you get to the local postmaster who sees a lot of mail and knows people. And, you know, obviously this isn't a more, you know, rural agrarian society than the one that a lot of us live in. But yeah, no, it absolutely happens that people send badly addressed letters or in different languages and things like that. And they have to track them down. And people send objects as well. You know, there are objects in the Smithsonian that have been sent to the mail that have never been tracked down who they're supposed to go to. So, no, absolutely, it does happen.
I would love to live one day of my life on a place called Crunchy Granola Road. Where is that?
So that was in West Virginia. Then again, like, when people were naming streets, you know, the question is, how do you name streets? As I said, a lot of people just pluck names out of the air. But in a lot of places, they wanted people to have, you know, some say on their names because it's important to them. But then the way people name streets in some ways was absolutely, you know, ridiculous. So somebody wanted to live on Crunchy Granola Road, so they get Crunchy Granola Road. And I guess it goes to the point that we think of our street names as sort of our expressions of our identity. I don't know what your identity is if you have Crunchy Granola Road, but you kind of conjure a kind of person who might think that was a fun name, in the same way that you might conjure an idea of a person, you know, who likes the idea of, you know, George Washington Street. I don't know. It's not a great example. But, you know, people have different ideas about, you know, what has meaning to them and the public face they want to put on the world. So it's one of the reasons why you do get some of the sillier names in sort of modern times.
So I live on a numbered street. And
yes.
The fact that I live on
you've
a numbers,
a lot of those.
Well, they're just everywhere. And, you know, I guess some of them become quite famous. There's Fifth Avenue, you know, New York,
and
that's all going to mean something to somebody. But I kind of resent just being on a numbered street. Talk to me about property value, because somehow the property value can tie into the way a street is named.
Absolutely. I mean, just even going back to your point about numbered streets is really interesting. As an American living in the UK, you know, in Europe, you hardly ever see numbered streets. I mean, I can think of very, very few examples. In America, they're the most popular street name. So Second Street, I believe, is the most common street name in America. The most common being because a lot of first streets are actually main streets. But I bet if the main streets were Canada's first streets, they'd be the most popular. And this is a very American thing, and there's lots of reasons for it. One of the main reasons that when they were surveying a lot of the land very, very quickly, you know, it was just much easier to give numbered streets. And you know, you have states like Utah that are very easy to be gridded and had ideology behind it. And it's very interesting. But property value does matter for some street names because, you know, some of them are quite are logical. You know, you might have an example I give in the book that a property expert gave was Lake Street. So streets on, you know, houses on streets called Lake Street go for more money, but that's usually because they're kind of near a nice lake, you know. Or houses on boulevards might have different values because that means probably a busy street with lots of neighbors, which could be a good or bad thing depending on the place. But property values is a really interesting thing in New York, for example, which had numbered streets, which has famously has numbered streets. But in the, I guess this was in the 19th century, a lot of landlords got together and banded together to change some of the numbered streets to names like Central Park West and Amsterdam Avenue. The grid, you know, the number stop at these streets, because they thought, for the very reason he said, that they needed a little bit more cachet or a bit more flair. So they purposely chose names they thought sounded a bit grand and a bit fancy to make the streets fancier. And it kind of worked in a way, because we do think of streets like Central Park West as being kind of, you know, fancy sounding streets. Now, Fifth Avenue is different, though. Fifth Avenue, I suppose, is just Fifth Avenue.
Deirdre Mask is author of The Address Book, What Street Addresses Reveal About Identity, Race, Wealth, and Power. And maybe street names don't exactly tickle your fancy, but there's some very cool scientific names, and we're going to talk about them in just a moment on Constant Wonder. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. If you happen to invent or discover something previously unknown, well, you got to give it a name. And there are some wild stories about names ladled out by scientists. I spoke with Stephen Hurd about this. He's a biology professor at the University of New Brunswick and author of Charles Darwin's Barnacle and David Bowie's Spider, How Scientific Names Celebrate Adventurers, Heroes, and Even a Few Scoundrels. Let's start out with that spider name, shall we?
That spider, which was discovered only about 15 years ago in Southeast Asia, was named for Bowie by a German zoologist who actually has named a number of things for musical people. But the spider in particular, it's got long, skinny legs, and it's got bright orange hair. And if you're like me, old enough to remember the Ziggy Stardust years, you know exactly why that makes sense to name that for David Bowie. You're right. Of course, Bowie doesn't need more accolades, right? But you hit the nail on the head when you said it can work both ways, because I think in a lot of cases, what I call celebrity naming like that is a way to bring attention to the really important job of discovering new species. And it's not a piece of science that gets a lot of headlines. It's not like the big super collider or the latest big laser fusion test. But it's a very important job, and these creatures that are getting named often need protection. And so one way, I think, to bring them into the public eye is to use a celebrity naming like this. And there was a fern named for Lady Gaga quite recently, for example. But this practice goes back a very long time. There was a fossil whale named for Herman Melville, for example, author of Moby Dick, so this sort of makes sense. It's also... it's just kind of fun to make these connections. And here's what I really like. There's a cockroach named for Jerry Garcia. And I just think, yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, there is just a fun list, a long fun list of some of these. I just want to mention a couple more. But, from Hogwarts and all of the Harry Potter stuff, that Sorting House spider. There's this weird spider, and I can't even tell if it's the abdominal part or if it's the head on this thing, but it looks just like one of those sorting hats.
It does. It's the abdomen. So the head is quite small, and the abdomen is this big conical thing. Well, big. It's not a huge spider, but it's got a conical abdomen with a little folded-over tip. And it looks a lot like the sorting hat in the movie. In the book, it's not described very clearly. And that spider was named by a fellow in India. And it's a marvelous naming. And I really like what he said in the paper where he described it. And I'm just going to try to find the exact wording he used. But that was a tribute, really, to the books and what they've meant to so many people who have sort of so many young people who have learned to love reading through Harry Potter, and the fellow who named that spider was one of those, I think, and he sort of had a tribute in that name, and in the paper he said, I'm not going to get the exact wording here, but it was an ode to magic lost and found. that is Areovixa Gryffindori. And of course, Gryffindor is not just the house in Harry Potter, but Godric Gryffindor was the original owner of that sorting hat before it became the sorting hat in Hogwarts. So it's named for a fictional person, Gryffindor, but with a nice connection. And it's really a beautiful looking spider. Not everyone likes spiders, but that spider is just really, really cool.
Well, back to Linnaeus, who started this all. I understand, because of you and your book, that he also took the opportunity of naming certain things to get some jabs out at other scientists. That's a little underhanded.
Yes, it is, and especially for Linnaeus, who wrote at some length about how naming a species was sort of a sacred duty and an honor, and a botanist should only do it for the best of reasons. But let me tell you this story. Linnaeus, I mentioned his sort of new system for classifying first plants and then more organisms into groups, and he very heavily weighted the reproductive structures of plants, so the stamens and pistils and anthers and so on, because he thought that gave an easy way to put similar plants together. So things that had two stamens went in one group, and things that had three stamens went in a different group, and so on and so forth. So called Linnaeus' sexual system. And we don't use it now, but it was an important step. But there was a Prussian botanist named Johann Sigisbeck, and he thought this was scandalous. He thought you just shouldn't be paying so much attention to the sexual parts of plants. And so Sigisbeck wrote in a book that Linnaeus' system was lewd, and he couldn't believe that plants would commit what he called such loathsome harlotry. he was pretty steamed. Well, so Linnaeus read that, right? And Linnaeus wasn't very happy. So Linnaeus named a plant after Sigisbeck. It's a plant called Sigisbeckia. It was the genus name he coined for him. And you think, oh, what a great honor, right? And maybe that's what Sigisbeck thought at first, too. But in fact, it's a weedy little plant, so not terribly attractive, and it has small flowers. And that matters, because Linnaeus had also explained that when you named a plant for someone, you should think about a plant that resembled that person in some way.
Oh, like the David Bowie thing.
The David Bowie spider, exactly. But in this case, you named a plant with small reproductive structures after Sigisbeck. It's like a couple of 12-year-olds on a schoolyard, right?
It sure is.
And so we have that plant to this day named after Sigisbeck, and people don't realize that's where it came from, but that was a name he did to insult someone. And actually, Linnaeus did that a couple of times. There were a few other ones. There's a plant called Dorstenia, and it has what Linnaeus described as flowers that appear somewhat faded, much like the career of Theodore Dorsten.
Stephen Hurd, a biology professor at the University of New Brunswick. He's author of Charles Darwin's Barnacle and David Bowie's Spider, How Scientific Names Celebrate Adventurers, Heroes, and Even a Few Scoundrels. Get ready to learn why the Little Ice Age was really such a big deal if you had to live through it. Maybe it was small in geological perspective, but the Nordic colonists in Greenland or English colonists struggling to get a foothold in North America, for them it was no small matter at all. That story when we return after the news for more Constant Wonder.